case, Fuente-Alvarado v. Garland, is submitted on the briefs, and we'll go to United States v. Wright.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Jessica Agatstein, Federal Defenders, on behalf of Joel Wright. So this is a compassionate release case controlled entirely by two of this Court's cases. So first, Arruda says that, as here, when a district court denies a motion based on guidelines dangerousness, it commits a legal error, and remand is the remedy. Second, Trujillo says that, as here, when a court does not address a sentencing argument, even in shorthand, remand is the remedy. Because the district court erred in this case under both Arruda and Trujillo, this court should reverse. So I'll start with the fact that Arruda had the same exact facts, it faced the same arguments, and it remanded. This court should remand as well.
And in Arruda, as here, now, the government's main argument, as I understand it, for the reason not to remand is because the district judge essentially did the same analysis under 3553A, so the reliance on the non-guidelines doesn't matter. And
that's my understanding of their argument
and
as well.
Were the circumstances in Arruda the same?
Yes. So the district court denied for two reasons, for 3553A and that Ms. Arruda didn't prove her lack of dangerousness. That's at 472 F sub 3rd, 856. And then the government argued in that case for affirmance because of the 3553A analysis, regardless of the guidelines. And then this court actually acknowledged the denial in its opinion on both dangerousness and 3553A in its opinion. That's at 993 F 3rd 799 and still reversed and remanded. So we're sort of faced with the same exact facts and arguments here.
But didn't we have a recent case, very recent, Smith, United States versus Smith, that says that if the district court considered Arruda separately from the 3553A factors, that was not error?
So the government relies on Keller, which I'm not sure of the case Smith you're referring to, but
it's case number 2150017. It's a Ninth Circuit 2021 case, 2021 WL4922412.
Okay.
Is it a published opinion? I mean, you don't know it, so you don't know if it's published.
Don't know if it's published.
All right. Well, I will make sure to save time on rebuttal and address that case, Your Honor. I apologize that I don't have it with me now.
If I just could explain it, just to follow up on that point, as I understand it, this court specifically held, very specifically rejected the argument you've raised here, Ms. Agatstein, because the court held, and this court held in October of this year, that if there is an Arruda error, such as that does not warrant remand when the record belies any contention that the district court's conclusion regarding the 3553A analysis was informed by 1B1.13 of the advisory guidelines. And reference was also made to an earlier opinion of this court in August of this year, United States versus Tadios, the same point that to the extent that there's reference to 1B1.13, as long as there's reference to other factors under 3553A, that the mere reference of 1B1.13 does not mandate under Arruda remand. That's essentially what the court has held on two different occasions since Arruda.
So two responses, Your Honor. So to the extent that that is the case on other kinds of 1B1.3, as you'll recall, 1B1.3 addresses several different points of compassionate release motions. To the extent that deals with extraordinary and compelling reasons for release, you know, that may be in a bit of tension with Arruda's outcome, but that does not control here because we're at the very same facts as Arruda. 1B1.3's direction as to dangerousness specifically, and those are the same facts we're dealing with here.
But did not the district court conduct a separate analysis under 3553A separately and distinctly from the dangerous analysis under 1B1.13? It was two separate analyses provided by the district court, was it not?
In both Arruda and here. That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Yes, but the court still reversed in Arruda. And under principles of stare decisis, even if other kinds of 1B1.3 analyses can, you know, still be wrong but affirmed on other grounds, under Arruda, simply this court has to follow the same outcome as this case. I think that's right for several reasons that I'm happy to address, but I don't believe that there's a published case that required that allows this court to affirm on the 3553A analysis because Arruda is so factually identical. So, for example, the government relies very heavily on Keller, where there was no legal error. So there was no reason to reverse. In fact, the only legal error was that the court allowed the case to go despite an issue with claims processing. And so there was no need to consider a remand there.
Are you going to address your other point?
Yes, I'm happy to. So the next point is about whether the court properly mentioned or explained its denial of about a 10-year home confinement request, even in shorthand. So here, there's simply no mention of home confinement, which is 10 years of home confinement is just very unusual. It's, you know, unheard of in the trial court. And the reason that defense counsel offered this alternative, you know, extreme proposal was to balance the seriousness of the offense with the real seriousness and change in Joel's physical situation. And so that very unusual proposal required an explanation or at least, you know, a notice in shorthand.
As I understand the government's response to your argument, it is that the proposal was a proposal for a condition of supervised release. And by determining that the sentence should not be the prison sentence should not be commuted, the judge was necessarily encompassing any possible terms of supervised release.
Yes, it's just that time served with release is so vastly different than time served with 10 years of home confinement.
But the 10 years of home confinement was meant to be a condition of supervised release, not directly a kind of confinement. I understand that the distinction is subtle, but it still required that he first be released.
That is correct, but you know the parties discussed the two as two totally different alternatives in their briefing, rather than addressing them as time served, you know, with or without this condition. And the facts of home confinement are so different in practice and really address many of the district court's concerns about dangerousness.
Ms. Agustin, if in a judgment and commitment order, home confinement is not a condition, a sentence. Under 5C1.1E3 of the advisory guidelines, one day of home detention is deemed to be equal to one day of incarceration, but it is not in any judgment and commitment order of which I'm aware part of the sentence. It always is, as Judge Berzin has suggested, it is always a condition of supervised release. It is never a matter of a sentence. So to the extent that there's a decision made on the sentence, how does one address the matter of home confinement? Because it is not a criminal sentence. It's a condition of supervised release.
Right. And it is presented in the guidelines, unlike any other condition of supervised release, as an alternative to incarceration.
Well, and under 5C1.1E3, it is specifically stated that one day of home detention may be deemed to equal one day of incarceration. But it's not a sentence. It's a condition of supervised release.
Absolutely. But it is in a really extreme. 10 years of home confinement is a fairly extreme request, and it's unheard of. I see that I am short on my time. I'll try to save the rest for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Green on behalf of the court, behalf of the United States. May it please the court. Your Honors, I guess I'd like to pick up with Arruda, since that was the focus of my colleagues' arguments this morning. There's one very significant factual distinction between this case and the case in Arruda, and that is that Judge Subraw explicitly and expressly recognized the possibility that the policy statement may not be binding. This was an argument that Mr. Wright's counsel made in their reply brief.
What difference does that make? He still decided under it. I don't know what difference that makes.
The court decided it and applied it, but in a footnote number one on page supplemental excerpts of the record, page 6, it's page 4 of the order. The court dropped a footnote here, and Judge Sobral effectively signaled that he understood that there may have been some debate on this, that he thought that the policy statement applied, but that in any event, Judge Sobral wrote, even if Mr. Wright was correct and it wasn't binding, the 3553A factors encompassed dangerousness by requiring the court to consider the need to protect the public.
Can I just clarify? I understand your argument, but Smith is not a published opinion, is that right?
Right.
Nor is the other case that was cited. So the only relevant precedent here is Arruda, is that right? I understand the distinction you're making, and we'll think about it, but the other opinions are all unpublished.
I'm not familiar with those opinions, but if they're unpublished, which I understand that they are, then that's correct. But the Keller is published. And given that there's a factual distinction here between our rights case and Arruda, and you look at Keller, there can only be one result here from Keller. The district court, after it determined that the 3553A factors did not allow the court to release Mr. Wright, there is only one possible result here from Keller, and that is that Mr. Wright's motion had to be denied. The importance, I think, of the footnote is that the court was conducting a separate 3553A analysis. And in the Arruda opinion, the court, at least from the opinion, didn't appear to grapple with the question of whether it was an independent 3553A analysis or whether the court considered the 3553A factors in connection with the policy statements. But in Judge Sobral's opinion, it was clear that he viewed the 3553A factors as a completely independent basis to deny Mr. Wright's motion. And when you understand that that was the court's position, and you then take Keller, and Keller teaches that if the 3553A factors do not allow for relief, then that's the end of the inquiry.
What you're saying, I think, Mr. Green, is that the district court did not incorporate its dangerous analysis into its 18 U.S.C. 3553A factor analysis, correct?
Correct. It explicitly said that even if Mr. Wright was correct, which he turned out to be, that the court would still deny the motion on 3553A. So that's a pretty significant distinction. And here to remand it, there couldn't really be any question that Mr. Wright would not end up in the same position because the court did an independent 3553A analysis, and it weighed strongly, or I think Judge Sobral said squarely, against Mr. Wright's release.
What about the defendant's other argument? That is that it is true, is it not, that the district court said nothing at all about the possibility of home detention?
That's true, and clearly from our discussion, the court understands that we believe that this is different because it was a supervised release condition. And Judge Sobral was clearly familiar with his ability to impose them. He had imposed stringent conditions on Mr. Wright's supervised release at the initial sentencing. But even if you find that, well, this is something that should be considered, you know, this court's case law is clear that the court doesn't have to tick through, you know, every single argument.
Yeah, but this was the major argument. It was not, as I understand it, the crux of the defendant's position was, you know, I have terrible medical conditions, and I understand, or at least his lawyer understood, that he did a terrible crime, but you can deal with both these situations by insisting on home detention. Now, I mean, there may well be responses to that, and I assume the government had them. I mean, some. On the other hand, the main argument was that given his medical condition, he really couldn't recidivate, and if he were at home, people would be safe. And there was no response to that at all.
Your Honor, I would, you know,
I understand the technical point, which is that what the judge said by refusing to release him encompassed the notion that there shouldn't be any supervised release conditions or no conditions, but he still never responded to the central argument.
I guess I would, I see it just slightly differently. I mean, I certainly have to acknowledge that Judge Sobrod didn't utter the words home detention in the order, but he tackled really the underlying arguments that Mr. Wright was making. So, for example, Judge Sobrod expressly found that Mr. Wright's conditions, his medical conditions, were not so diminished that he could not recidivate. He found that various 3553A factors that don't just go to whether he would be a danger if he was placed at home, but that there were other factors that still warranted against a time-served sentence, like promoting respect for the law and having there be just punishment for this, you know, really bad offense, plainly stated. And if you look at the court's order, again, even grappling with Mr. Wright's footnotes in his reply brief, as I've mentioned, there can't really be any question that Judge Sobrod understood the request. He considered it. He grappled with it. He issued a lengthy opinion. And while he did not tick off, you know, home detention in the order, the record is very clear that he considered it, and he gave an extensive.
Tell me why the record is clear that he considered it.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Why is the record clear that he considered it?
The seven-page opinion, the depth of the analysis.
The seven-page opinion says nothing about the home detention, so why is it clear that he considered it?
Acknowledging that, we would submit that the record otherwise.
Did he not? The record reflects that he's very specifically said, there's a strong need to protect the public, end of quote, and that the, quote, offense was incredibly serious, end of quote. And indeed, the appellant's the brief, Ms. Agustin's brief, specifically acknowledges, quote, that the court extensively considered, end of quote, whether to grant his request for release. Isn't that in the record?
That's true, Your Honor. And
I guess I should probably ask Ms. Agustin, how does the strong need to protect the public not jive with talking about home confinement? If there's a strong need to protect the public, one is not released to home detention, quite simply, from my experience.
I'm prepared to submit. I just would, again, focus, in addition to what Judge Bennett has pointed to, that Judge Sobrod believes that Mr. Wright still poses a danger. And even with his medical conditions, Judge Sobrod believes that his condition is not so diminished that he could not recidivate. He didn't mention home detention, but that effectively answers that question.
Was there a hearing on the compassionate release? There wasn't, right?
No, I believe this was decided on the papers.
I mean, if there had been, it would be much more obvious, because there would have been an argument, and Judge Sobrod, presumably the home detention would have come up, and Judge Sobrod presumably would have said something about it, or at least we know that he heard it and it was encompassed in his decision, but there was no hearing. So it is a bit of a stretch to think that we can tell from what actually happened here that he considered it. So I guess what I'm asking you is this. Is the technical fact that this is a condition of supervised release and not a basis for non-release alone enough? Or should there have been some explanation and ordinarily?
Your Honor, I would say that the fact that it is a condition of supervised release, put together with the fact that the court is not always required to tick off every single argument.
But this isn't. This is the central argument. I mean, that's not. It seems to me it was a central submission. It wasn't mentioned. Unless, and there was no response to it, unless there was no need to do it because he denied the release and that was enough, he had no obligation to discuss the conditions of supervised release, which is a coherent argument, then I think he didn't do it. If he had any obligation to do it, he didn't do it.
Well, In this circumstance, Your Honor, we do not believe that he needed to address it once he answered the question that time served was not appropriate.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ms. Thank you for considering my argument. Thank you.
Two quick points. So first, my colleague said that the district court considered 3553A and the dangerousness analysis as independent. But the court on page ER7 said many of the 3553A factors overlap with the 3142G factors. So there was a relationship there.
What about Keller?
Yes. So in Keller, there was no legal error and thus no need to decide what to do about remand. There was the 3553A analysis was sufficient. There was no other error. There was no need to figure out what to do when there was a legal error, particularly one that really seeps in the 3553A, like the dangerousness analysis. But I do also want to point out, Arruda, if anything, had a more independent analysis of 3553A versus dangerousness in the district court, and this court still remanded.
Although there was less clearly, the district court there less clearly equated the protecting the public part of 3553A and the dangerousness part of what I'm calling the non-guideline. So it was less clear about the fact that it was specifically finding the dangerousness piece within the 3553A. Do you think that's right?
I think that's right. I think they were very independent in that case. And then on the point about supervised release, I think one reason to remand is because the district court's opinion is, if anything, a little bit at odds with its actually considering home confinement. And I think that for three reasons. One is when in the district court's analysis about whether Joel could recidivate, it noted the government's position that maybe he could engage in international travel, maybe he could use the internet. Of course, Joel not only will have very strict internet monitoring on home confinement, but he can't see his computer. He's blind. And the recidivate through cross-country and international travel, I mean, not only would he have an ankle monitor, but he can't go to the bathroom by himself, he can't eat by himself, he can't really move long distances without help.
But that's all true anyway. So when the judge found that he couldn't do these things, for some reason, he was disregarding his circumstances. And why would it be any different with regard to the home release?
An ankle monitor and internet use, both of which would be addressed through his very stringent conditions of home confinement and supervised release. I think the third point was discussing, you know, the lengthy time remaining on his sentence. Obviously, home confinement is different from being incarcerated in the BOP, but it is still considered a form, an alternative to incarceration that would address some of those factors.
I mean, the district judge, if we were to remand, certainly could find it wasn't good enough. There would be various reasons. I mean, we don't know anything about his family and whether they actually would keep watch over him, and I don't know what the record is about that. I also have no idea how old they are and whether they're going to be around for 10 years. Because once he's released is the other problem. There are lots of good reasons why the district judge might decide this wasn't good enough, but your point is he didn't do it.
Yeah, we don't know exactly
right.
What those would be.
Thank you very much. The case of United States versus Wright is submitted.
Thank you.